Holly.
No kidding.
How about that?
Well, that's
where I drive by every morning. So it's still there. It's still there.
I'm happy to hear.
Your Honor, I am Steve Sims from Baltimore, representing Transtech, and so we go from the dark alleys of Pasadena to the bright port of Long Beach, where there are containers moving from all sorts of parts of the world and large container ships pulling in and out from places like Korea and Hong Kong and circulating throughout the world.
Happily, this one is gone, right?
It's
not still arrested in Long Beach Harbor, right?
This ship was arrested in 2003. Security was put up, and it sailed somewhat happily.
Seven seas.
Yes, somewhat happily. And that's exactly the picture that the court should have as it looks at this situation, because this isn't an isolated transaction. That what we're looking at is a transaction of a steamship line that had I think 8 to 10 ships, of which the Harmony Container was one. The Harmony Container went in a continuous loop from Long Beach or Manzanillo, which is just below San Diego. Lots of U.S. cargo comes in from there too, over to Hong Kong, up to Korea, and back again. And like you refuel your car, depending on when you're driving in Long Beach or Pasadena or San Diego or wherever you are, these ships refuel all over the world, and they refuel with suppliers like Transtech. And Transtech, the record shows, had a ongoing relationship with Ken Hung, this charter. And in that relationship was based on contract. And the contract had a choice of law clause. And the choice of law clause was a choice of United States law. Why? Because there are many jurisdictions that are involved, including the United States. It's undisputed that this load of fuel that we're talking about here got the ship from Korea across the Pacific to Manzanillo to deliver cargo to the United States. This case is about the essential nature of choice of law clauses in international contracts, and particularly this kind of contract, and also the freedom of contract. And related to that, the freedom of these parties, whether United States law or Malaysia law applies, to choose the law that they want to apply to the transaction.
There's two ways to get to the United States law. One is that Malaysian law applies, and then you determine whether or not under Malaysian law you would give credence to the U.S. choice of law provision. And so the answer could be yes or no. If the answer is yes, you end up with U.S. law, and you end up, that's where you want to be, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so let's just assume, or you get there directly.
Yes.
So let's just assume you get to U.S. law. It seems to me the more, and whether we get to U.S. law or not is, I mean, those are sort of traditional questions we deal with all the time, and so those are not complicated. But if it's U.S. law, does it apply to provision of these necessities or necessaries outside of the territorial jurisdiction of the United States?
Yes. Wow. And this is when we're going to talk about the Trinidad case of the Fifth Circuit. The court's Gulf trading decision.
The 11th or the 5th?
It's the 5th.
Okay.
It is, back then it was the 5th. The court's Gulf trading decision, what did it say? It said if there's a U.S. supplier providing necessaries in a foreign port, there's a maritime lien. What did the Fifth Circuit's Queen of Le Mans case say? It said if there's a foreign supplier supplying a necessary in a U.S. port, although that was about marine insurance and the foreign supplier was a London insurer collecting for insurance which insured the ship all over the world, then that's okay. So what do we have the court saying already? U.S. supplier, foreign supply, maritime lien.
Which case is this?
This is the Queen of Le Mans case.
Okay.
And in the Gulf trading case, U.S. supplier, foreign supply, maritime lien. Queen of Le Mans, foreign supplier in the U.S., maritime lien. Looking back at the legislative history, which is what the Camilla Court did not do, and just to step aside for a second, the unfortunate thing of the development of maritime commerce where things move in containers and there are fewer actors involved in the system, is that, that courts are less and less experienced in maritime law. And so things you see things like this Camilla Doctrine saying that there's no maritime lien for foreign supplies by foreign suppliers in foreign ports repeated over and over again as gospel when it's not supported at all. And what the court needs to do is to go back into the history of United States maritime lien law, and what the court did in Camilla was really turn it on its head. United States maritime lien law has always been, if we want to use the word, extraterritorial. The only change that there's ever been statutorily in maritime lien law to the way maritime liens apply was around the turn of the century, overturning what was called the home port doctrine. And the home port doctrine was that you did not have a maritime lien for a provision that you gave to a ship in its own home port. So if you were a supplier in New Orleans and the ship was based in New Orleans and you gave stuff to the ship in New Orleans, you didn't have a maritime lien. Now that's about as domestic as it gets. But the cases we've cited in the brief, the Scotland, the Lackawanna, the discussion in Benedict's, the treatise, all talk about saying, yes, you know, if there's a foreign supply, a foreign provider, the ship shows up in the U.S., it's arrested, you bet there's a maritime lien. So when you dig behind the Camilla case and you look at the legislative history, what it's doing is seizing on the 1971 amendments. The only change there was that there didn't have to be inquiry by the supplier about whether there was a no-lien clause in the contract. And this court in the Gulf Trading case said, pointed to the legislative history, and we attached it to our brief, and it said, who's in the better position to take care of the question of whether a maritime lien arises against the ship?
Okay, but that's all governed by statute now, right?
It is statute codifying the maritime law, yes.
So what... Let's take the way this law is written. It says if you provide necessaries, you get a lien. That's basically what it says.
Yes.
So the question then is, if all of the conduct related to that takes place outside the territorial jurisdiction in the United States, do you still get a lien?
Yes.
Okay. So if you look at most U.S. statutes, they kind of read like this. Let's take the copyright statute. More or less, it tells you what your copyright, what's protected under the copyright, and then it tells you you can sue somebody if they violate that. But, of course, we say you can't do it for copyright violations that occur outside the territory of the United States. Now, the statute reads a lot like this statute. It doesn't say anything about in or outside the United States. It just talks about you get a certain right. But then the U.S. Supreme Court has said, yeah, but it doesn't extend beyond the boundaries. Why is this statute different?
Well, take a copyright violation. If I have a someone in France that's infringing my copyright, right? Copyright law, the way it's been construed, says I can't go to France and sue somebody on U.S. law based on that copyright violation. Maritime law is different.
It says you can't. Whether you can go to France or not, it's up to French law. What the U.S. law says is you can't sue in the United States for the violation that occurred in France.
Correct.
Okay.
And the Gulf Trading case, the remand in the U.S. In the Exxon case says maritime law is different. You make a provision in a foreign port where U.S. law applies, you may arrest the ship when it pulls into the U.S. And there are a lot of other places that you could arrest the ship too, as a matter of fact. Canada, Panama, different sorts of places like that. But what has gone on here is that Judge Wilson and...
Isn't that what Tento was about?
Yes.
I mean, Tento was everything happened abroad except there was a U.S. Authority.
Yes.
And we held that... the lien apply, right?
Yes. And it was in, Italy, I think. and the Exxon case.
Someplace not in the U.S.
Not in the U.S.
Someplace not in the U.S. And so the presumably the supplier could have done what they wanted to do in Italy under Italian law. The ship was there. Saudi Arabia, same with the Exxon, I think could have done what it did there, but they waited until the ship pulled into the U.S. and arrested it here. And so whether you go through Malaysian law or U.S. law, and let's go into Malaysian law here, there was nothing presented before the court, and Malaysian law is really interesting. It is actually very accessible. It's all in Lexis. And it was interesting to go through it. But so it's not a matter of finding the law of Malaysia. The what we didn't find, what wasn't found, what Judge Wilson noticed wasn't found, was anything that prohibited the incorporation of U.S. law into this contract under Malaysian law. Now, how do we have a spot check to know that that's okay?
So, and the contract you're referring to is the contract for the sale of the bunkers?
Correct.
Not the contract for the lease of the vessel.
Yes, but there's my...
I'm sorry.
The charter.
We're not talking about the charter. Contract.
No, we're not talking about the charter. We're
talking about the sale of the bunkers.
Yes, Your Honor. That set the United States law as the basis for the transaction. But when you do look at the charter party incorporates English law. And you say, well, you know, don't choices law clauses have to have something to do with the parties? These parties have nothing to do with English law. There it is in the charter party. Well, that's what Malaysian law allows. That's what Judge Wilson read the case law to do. And that's what it does. As a matter of freedom of contract, if you apply Malaysian law will allow the importation of United States law for the contract, which makes sense here because these ships are going all over the place. And when the ship pulls into Long Beach, Malaysian law will recognize the law of the forum to support that choice of United States law for the arrest. And that's so we did exactly what the plaintiff did.
So the consent to the contract creates the power, the authority for us to rule on the case. Is that right?
It is the start. The consent to the contract is...
But the consent, I mean, the odd thing about it is consent is not by the vessel owner who's stuck with the bill, but this other guy who specifically is barred by contract from putting a lien on the vessel.
Well,
and he consents and he says, well, I agree to U.S. law, which does exactly what I have promised not to do. And the vessel owner doesn't even get asked the question.
That's exactly what United States law does. United States law allows charters to enter into bunker contracts. And the problem pre-1971 was that the charters, and they still are, full of no lien clauses. And so Congress said, no, we're going to put the burden on the ship owner who has the best chance of policing the way that its charterers do their business to communicate no lien clauses, to make sure that any bunker suppliers or any suppliers are on notice that there can't be a lien of the charter. It's the ship owner's affirmative duty to do this. These are not unsophisticated people. These are.
And how do they do it? They nail something to the side of the ship?
That's one way to do it.
I'm just asking.
That's one way to do it. You
really?
Require your charterer to... Yes.
How would they have figured that out when... It wasn't like they were looking at the ship when they were signing the contract.
Yes. The other way to do it is you get you require your charterer to report to you the suppliers that it has, and you communicate out to them. You send them no lien letters. You require the charterer to put a stamp. Now, in this transaction, what could have happened? Ken Hung orders the bunkers. Transtech comes back and says, here's your deal. Ken Hung, when it ordered the bunkers, it could say, now I want you to know that we're operating under a charter that with a no lien clause, you're not going to have any maritime lien against this ship. They didn't do it. That's what the owner could have required Ken Hung to do. And these people are not people who are unknown to each other. The record shows the close relationship between the principals of Ken Hung and the principals of the Malaysians in the ship-owning company. And so they all know who they are. And this is what goes on in maritime commerce. If credit is not supported by maritime liens, everything falls apart. Why is that? Because the ship has to earn the money necessary to pay the necessaries providers. If the necessaries providers had to demand money up front all the time, then maritime commerce would grind to a halt.
Well, what would be the contract, though? Let's say that the ship owner puts out an international bulletin to all suppliers, and these are known suppliers. You just told me there's a kind of a known community. International bulletin. We do not do lien contracts, right?
Yes.
So then Kian Hung, in effect, signs up with these terms and conditions because it gets them. So then what do you have?
Then you have the supplier on notice that the charter does not have authority to incur maritime liens against the ship, overcoming the presumption of U.S. law that it does. Happens all the time. And you'll see in the case law there's fights over whether there was proper communication of this sort of thing.
Let me ask a different question. So if the maritime lien that takes effect here under U.S. law, does it have any viability outside of a U.S. port?
Yes. Some countries will recognize it, some won't. Panama, Canada, France, some ports in India will recognize it.
All the important places.
They're fresh in my mind, yeah.
But a U.S. court's only jurisdiction would be if the ship were in a U.S. port. Is that correct?
Yes. There's no way a U.S. court can send a marshal out to...
Right.
Although they'd like to go to Tahiti, it's kind of, you know...
Well, and the reason I'm asking, I mean, it seems sort of stupid, I know, but it's different in that respect than a copyright claim, because you are dealing with a physical, tangible, and in rem situation in which you are physically in the United States at the time of enforcement.
For U.S. courts enforcement, it's in rem. The court's jurisdiction depends on the rest being before the court. Absolutely. I see I have about 2.5 minutes left. I wanted to respond to Mr. Gorman, if that's all right with the court.
Sure. Why don't you save the rest for rebuttal?
Thank you.
Good morning. I'd like to start off by, and before I make my presentation, in direct rebuttal of some of the comments made by my colleague. First of all, there is, in response to the contention that because the vessel sails to U.S. ports, that somehow should be a sufficient connection. There's case law that's cited in our brief that says that's simply not a sufficient U.S. connection, where all the other points of contact are foreign. The vessel did go to Mexico from Korea, Manzanillo. Yes, it did ultimately come into the United States, but it went to Mexico first. The Gulf trading case that was cited by counsel, that involved a U.S. supplier. And the whole key here is how we're going to look at this transaction. Is this really a freedom of contract case?
This is Tento?
Gulf Trading.
Gulf Trading versus Tento.
I'm sorry. It was
that's
a U.S.
Ninth Circuit case, 1980.
Yes, Ninth Circuit, and I have it right here.
Yes.
And I read it just before I came up. And there was a U.S. supplier with substantial U.S. connection. And under the 1971 amendments, that's who we were protecting. Congress said, we're sick and tired of U.S. suppliers getting not being paid, when they're the ones that are subject to the no lien provisions.
I don't remember seeing Congress saying that. Where did they say that?
Say again?
Where did Congress say that?
When they passed...
We're tired. You just said Congress... said we're tired of
it's in the legislative history that the amendment was passed to protect U.S. suppliers. The 1971 amendment. Pardon me?
It was just U.S. suppliers?
U.S. suppliers, that's right, for the presumption of authority. Because Congress changed the law to presume authority where the presumption of authority from the vessel owner was for the protection of U.S. suppliers. That's clearly in the legislative history. The Queen of Le Mans involved P&I insurance premiums, and again, look at the impact that the Queen of Le Mans case had in the United States. And that's why we have the extraterritorial application, because of a matter of respect for the international law and the law and the maritime laws of other countries, we look at what? Are U.S. citizens affected? Or is there an impact in the United States? And it was a question, and on all these cases involve the impact within the United States on a U.S. supplier or some situation such as a casualty that has impact in the United States. And that's the rationale for why the lien statute should not be applied extraterritorially.
You mean, you started talking about the Queen of Le Mans case.
Sir?
You started talking about the Queen of Le Mans case, but I didn't understand your point. You said what impact it had. Queen of Le Mans is pretty clear. It says, look, if the parties agree to it, that's good enough. If the contract provides for U.S. law as a choice of as applicable law, freedom of contract, that's fine. What's wrong with that decision? And what impact did it have that you're talking about?
The Queen of Le Mans, the fact that the premiums involved, if the vessel didn't have P&I insurance and the vessel suffered a casualty within the United States, there would be an impact in the United States.
That's not what they said. Is that the rationale they used?
That's the right.
I have it right here.
Yes, I know you. Okay.
Well, where?
The court said that.
Tell me where. Tell me where.
As I recall, the Queen of Le Mans, the
court said.
You don't
have the case there?
Huh? I don't have the case right here, no. The court said that that two parties agreed that the existence of a lien, the existence of a lien would be determined by the law of the jurisdiction where the vessel was located. At the time, the court, or that the time the P&I Club sought to enforce its claim. That, I submit, is different than here.
It looks to the success. Look, the parties agree, that's good enough for us. If it's in the contract, it's good enough for us. And here it's in the contract.
Well,
do you dispute that? Do you dispute it's in the contract? The U.S. choice of law clause?
I think that the U.S. choice of law clause shouldn't be respected here for the simple reason that, for 14 reasons, in fact, that it abrogates statutory rights under the law of every country that would otherwise touch the transaction. And it gives effect.
Mean?
I'm sorry?
What does that mean?
What it means is this. The court has already determined that Malaysian law applies. Malaysian law gives a statutory lien, not a maritime lien. Korea gives a statutory lien. Singapore gives a statutory lien.
Sure.
There's certain, and 90% of the maritime jurisdictions
but
in the world.
But if Malaysian law were to say, yeah, we have a statutory lien, but if parties have a contract, they can agree to waive the lien, or they can agree to the law of Ulaanbaatar. Why wouldn't you give effect to what Malaysia does in terms of choice of law?
Because two parties can agree. What we're talking about here is affecting third parties. We're talking about abrogating the statutory rights of third parties. Not only are we talking about the rights of the vessel owner here, but we're also talking about the rights of the vessel's other creditors.
You talk
and we're
about
giving them a favored
rights.
Position.
You talk about statutory rights. What are these statutory rights? Where are these?
The statutory rights under the law of Malaysia, a supplier gets a statutory lien, and as and he does not get a maritime lien. He gets a statutory lien.
Well, how does this undermine the statutory lien on Malaysia? He still gets a statutory lien. You also get a maritime lien under U.S. law. How does that abrogate? Does this somehow nullify the statutory lien on the Malaysian law?
Yes,
if
it
this,
does.
If this ship had sailed into the harbor in, what, Malaga or Kuala Lumpur or someplace, Malaysia, they would have a statutory lien. This would undermine the statutory lien at all, would it?
Well, the lien arises by operation of law, does it not? And it arises at the time and place where the bunkers are furnished. And they were furnished in Korea. And the statutory lien says that you have a right to arrest the vessel to enforce the statutory lien so long as the contracting party, i.e. the charterer, still has an interest in the vessel. That's not the case here. So by granting, by enforcing a U.S. choice of law clause in this agreement, you've then abrogated the statutory lien that all the laws of 90% of the maritime nations give.
But that's because they agreed to it.
That's because the charterer and the vessel and the supplier agreed to it. Assuming they did, and it's my position that they didn't.
Let's just assume they
did. But that's a different
for talking purposes.
Right. For discussion purposes, you're assuming that they did. And the question really arises as to whether or not there is a reasonable expectation for third parties to expect that under the circumstances of this case that U.S. law would apply. Just don't forget, we're not talking about just a U.S. choice of law clause here. We're talking about deemed provisions. The contract will be deemed to be consummated when we grant the credit. The contract will, the bunkers will be deemed to be supplied in the United States. The supplier is deeming himself all over the place to create a fictional U.S. connection. And I submit that where there's fictional contractual provisions that purport to bind third parties, there needs to be a substantial U.S. connection, there needs to be a U.S. impact, and there should be a reasonable expectation that these third parties should be bound by a choice of law that has no connection otherwise to the transaction.
What is your best authority for the notion that if you have a third party impacted by a contract, that for purposes of the choice of law analysis, they basically have bidding rights?
That they have what?
In effect, bidding rights. That's what you're sort of saying here is, look, they ought to be able to come in and say this is unreasonable vis-a-vis my situation and my ship. What is the best?
Well, that was the best case would be the reasoning supplied by the by Judge Gauthier in the Canadian case, who, by the way, before she was appointed, was head of the Canadian Maritime Law Association, as well as the MV Tequila, which also holds that, and there's a several district court cases which also hold that. That there's no U.S. maritime lien for necessary supplied in a foreign port to a foreign, by a foreign
but,
supplier.
But we don't. Do we really have a? Is there any circuit case that alludes to this other than the 11th Circuit?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay.
No. In any event, going on, if we talk about the Malaysia choice of law, I believe that there is a misstatement about what Malaysia law does. I think Malaysia law, and the only evidence on Malaysia law, is what it would do here is that Malaysia law holds that the lex causae and the lex fori both have to recognize the lien before a maritime lien can be enforced. You don't get either or. And I think that the use of the word also, and it's cited in my brief, where Malaysia would not recognize a maritime lien unless the lex fori also recognizes a maritime lien, I don't think we can ignore the term, the use of the word also. The charters, the council says the charters are full of no lien clauses. Of course they are, because 90% of the maritime nations of the world say that this is the scheme upon which you do business. Only the United States, which favors U.S. suppliers, grants the presumption of authority. And I submit that where there's contractual fictions, what I call these deemed provisions, that there has to be something more.
France also accepts that, right?
Say again, please?
France also does.
France accepts a maritime lien in certain circumstances, but not to the same extent.
That gets us all the way to Tahiti, doesn't it?
Say again, please?
That gets us all the way to Tahiti, doesn't it?
That gets us to Tahiti. That does indeed.
I mean, it's not just France proper. I mean, France has possessions all over the Pacific, Caribbean, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so you know, it's not a trivial minority.
I'm not suggesting that it is. What I'm suggesting is that why should the U.S. lien statute presumptively apply to a foreign transaction? There seems to be no legislative history
really a pretty clear-cut question on this one point. And the question is, does the fact that parties agree to U.S. law, should that be determinative as to whether or not you adopt U.S. lien law? And you could go one way or the other. Queen of Le Mans goes one way, and the MV Tequila, Rainbow Line versus MV Tequila goes the other way. Second Circuit says you do a balancing analysis on the Lauritzen, and the Fifth Circuit in Queen of Le Mans says freedom of contract. We parties are sophisticated; they all know what they are doing. If they say that's they adopt U.S. law, there's no reason to dispute that.
And the Ninth Circuit and Kento said
There's a lot to be said for both positions.
If you analyze this as a question of freedom of contract and bind non-parties to that agreement, that's certainly one way to look at it, isn't it?
It's not that big a deal because these are not total strangers. They all know, so long as the rules are established, it doesn't really matter, in a sense, what the rules are, because if your client is aware that, in fact, your charterers can buy bunkers and bind themselves to U.S. law, then what they'll have to do is be more vigilant about sending out notices that says our charters do not have that authority. And yeah, you can't fault your clients for having been terribly vigilant about making this known to people who sell supplies to your charters, right? Your client could have done a better job of letting parties know. But the only thing that really matters is to have the rules clearly established. Once the rules are clearly established, your client is a big guy. Same is true of the people on the other side. Everybody knows what the rules are. You can adjust accordingly.
Well, I think that that's not the correct way to look at it, because there ought to be some reasonable expectation on the part of the owner and third-party creditors that that body of law would apply. And in the circumstances of this transaction, there is none.
If we say it is, it is. If we say that's expectation, then it becomes the reasonable expectation. And then from now on in, people will realize, gee, if you are in that situation and your ship winds up sailing into U.S. waters, particularly U.S. waters of the Ninth Circuit, you're going to get stuck. So you better make darn sure that people are aware that your charters don't have the authority to consent to liens. It doesn't strike me as that big a deal one way or the other. I mean, that is for the purpose of this transaction, but in terms of future conduct, all we need is a rule, right?
What we need is a clear rule and a clear rationale, and I submit that...
Okay, well, how about this for a clear rationale? If you put it in the contract, then we will apply it in the United States. Your client will know what the rule is, and then I would guess they would then send out emails and telegrams and, you know, whatever they send out, saying, as to any of our ships, don't count on this because none of our charters have authority to bind these liens. And you would do this every month or two, and you would buy ads in the London newspapers, those papers that have ship notices and all those things. You can guard against it. It's not that big a deal.
Then you put the rabbit back in the hat as to how the vessel owner or the creditors are going to satisfy these deemed provisions with regard to actual notice.
Well,
because you're dealing with the whole
contract.
Let me ask
it a different way. Judge Kaczynski posits one way it might be certain, but what is the rule that you would ask us to adopt?
I would ask you to adopt the rule that where there's no connection between the actual facts in the transaction and you're going to bind third parties, that there be in order to apply the Lien Act extraterritorially, there be a substantial connection between the transaction and the United States.
Okay, so apply that rule to the Tento case. MV Tento, Gulf Trading,
yes.
Transportation versus MV Tento.
And Gulf was a U.S. supplier.
But that's all. There's nothing about the transaction that had any contact with the United States. It happened to be the identity of one of the parties.
That's, with due respect, sir, the bunkers were ordered through a New York broker in Gulf.
Right, that's what I was
saying.
The
transaction had a U.S. locus. Because the bunkers were ordered in New York, and the Panama Canal funds. They were supplied in Italy, but they were paid for by the Gulf Oil in the United States. Gulf Oil was the one who suffered the loss. Gulf Oil was the one that was held to have the right to enforce. There was a U.S. impact on the transaction, and that's the rule that I'm asking you to recognize, which continues the line of Tento.
Let me change the fact of Tento just a little bit. Let's say that, in fact, this was brokered through New York, but none of the parties were American. But they used it was brokered through a New York Java.
My response is that if it's not a U.S. supplier, then the reach of the lien shouldn't extend.
So where's your clarity of transaction then? Now they would say, but there was a contact, and then you'd be back here arguing, well, you used the U.S. job, or you used a contact that was brokered through New York, that's enough of a contact. Isn't it much clearer to say, look, if it's in the contract, U.S. law applies. Very clear. Black and white. It's on the contract. It applies.
No, I'm saying that if there's a U.S. Supplier and there's a U.S. impact, That's the rule that needs to be recognized, because that's the rule that's been recognized in the cases.
Let me change it a little differently. What if you have a foreign corporation supplying to a foreign ship, but in a U.S. port?
There's a U.S. impact, isn't there?
I don't know.
Yes, there is.
You tell us.
Because the impact within the territorial jurisdiction is clear. And why shouldn't the U.S. law apply? It should.
But all the U.S. does under this version of the hypothetical is all you've got is people there pumping oil. It's not oil that belongs to the United States, anybody in the United States. They just happen to be the place where the thing is delivered. So the people actually pumping the oil are Americans, but nobody else is. The oil is owned by a foreign party. The ship is a foreign party. The charter was a foreign party. The job was a foreign party. It just so happens that the ship needs oil in the United States, so they have it delivered there.
That's a hypothetical that has absolutely no realistic chance of ever becoming a reality, because there's no foreign oil suppliers within the United States that would be supplying bunkers to a ship within the U.S. You're talking about a situation where...
The problem I have is you keep saying it's U.S. suppliers, but it's not written that way. And the statute isn't ambiguous, so I appreciate the legislative history, and I read the portions that you quoted, which are somewhat persuasive, but then I'm not sure where you're supposed to even go there in terms of looking at the statute and looking at a contract. What even gets us to the legislative history?
What gets us to the legislative history, I submit, is because you're affecting the rights of third parties who aren't parties to this agreement in derogation of the laws of other countries that would otherwise apply. And that leads me right into the issue as to whether or not the U.S. choice of law and the other provisions were ever validly incorporated into the bunker confirmation. And I submit that, and as argued in my brief, that they were not. And I think the lower court ignored a Singapore case right on point. We're talking about these unusual provisions, and they're unusual in this sense. If you look at the bunker transaction as it existed, bunkers supplied by a Singapore supplier to a Malaysian vessel in Korea. You're altering by contract that scheme. Under those facts, there's no reasonable expectation that U.S. law would apply, or that the transaction would be governed by any other law other than the law of Malaysia, Singapore, or Korea. Now, if you're going to change that scheme by contract, and if you're going to affect third parties, including vessel owners, then I submit that change ought to be clear, explicit, and fairly and reasonably brought to the attention of the other contracting party. And the cases that are cited in the brief hold that they are not.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have about 2.5 minutes, 2 minutes and 47 seconds for rebuttal.
Let me just ask, we would be at odds with the 11th Circuit if we were to adopt your position, wouldn't we?
No. If you look at Queen of Le Mans, 2002, they said nothing about this Trinidad case. Think of the appellate panel in 2002 looking back at Trinidad. You've got a foreign supplier.
Maybe they didn't. Well, we don't know.
Well, it's their court.
Judges aren't perfect.
And it's the only thing before that on, that's a great thing about maritime law. You don't have a whole lot of cases. So there's Queen of Le Man, or Trinidad, sitting
right
there.
That's the bad thing about maritime law.
It depends on how you look at it. If you, you know, have, never mind. But here's Trinidad, and it says, okay, here's a foreign supplier. Lots of the insurance was supplied outside the U.S. Says nothing about the U.S. interest, by the way, and whether there's insurance. And the panel's sitting here and saying, good grief, there's nothing that supports this. So there's Queen of Le Man. And they don't mention Trinidad. There's no discussion of Trinidad in any of these cases. An interesting thing about the no-lien notices, Your Honor, that you mentioned is that this was a time charter. The owner's people were the people on the boat. They were the people getting the confirmations. They were the people knowing who the suppliers were getting it. There was absolutely great information going back to the owners from their own people on the boat, because it's a time charter, about who the suppliers were. They're in a great position to communicate no lien clauses that's in their charter. Why didn't they do that? Because everything would have come to a grinding halt. Nobody would have sold bunkers to this ship. We talked about the artifice of law applying in a contract binding third parties. Let's take a look at the charter. English law. They say, as a matter of English law, in this charter, there's no liens. Well, what's good for the owner is good for the supplier. But the way when you apply United States law here, which is what the parties chose, the outcome is that it's now up to the owner, whose people are on the boat, to communicate this problem. As far as making it explicit, Judge Wilson dealt with that very well. He looked at the closest analogy, which was arbitration clauses. And he says, no, you know, even if this were a arbitration clause question, which it isn't, the arbitration clause would come in. But as far as choice of law, this is an international transaction. This is what people expect to see in a contract, an international clause. And by the way, this is not a new issue. What do bunker suppliers want? They want liens. They want to apply United States law. Malaysia has no problem with the court doing that here. What the owner's side is asking this court to do is to say, well, we're going to second guess Malaysia law here. We're gonna impose our American sensibilities, supposedly about extraterritoriality, which doesn't apply here, on what Malaysian courts would say. As far as Malaysian courts say, the lex causae, the provision under an agreed choice of law clause, United States, matching the lex fori, Long Beach, where the ship pulled in, perfectly okay to arrest. Interesting thing about this ship, it never went to Malaysia. It never came to Malaysia. We're not talking about the ship pulling into Kuala Lumpur, getting a supply here, and having Malaysia law apply. We're talking about a ship going all over the place, never coming anywhere close to Malaysia, and coming into the port of Long Beach, just like the Tenneth case.
I have one other question, and that is, parties can contract to almost anything, and they contract to all kinds of governing law in international contracts. So the fact that they contracted to U.S. law simply means that the laws of the United States apply. But if a lien cannot arise on a wholly foreign transaction, a party's contract couldn't override that principle, could it?
If a lien can arise on a wholly foreign transaction, you know, I will be taking an airplane home. I mean, I won't be flying by myself. The way the law is, and looking back into the history of maritime lien law that we set out in our brief, these hoary, dusty Supreme Court cases, talk about that's the way maritime lien law works. There's a foreign supply by a foreign supplier, ordered by a person with authority. They show up in the U.S., you arrest them. It happened all the time into the 19th century, into the 20th century. The 1971 amendments didn't change that a bit, except the duty of inquiry about no lien clauses. And in the Tinto, setting out the legislative history, the court said, put it on the supplier. After all, they know that maritime liens are going to be a problem. It's in their charter. They say, you can't incur these. What's the remedy for the ship owner? you've got a breach of charter party. Just like they didn't pay rent, they incurred a lien. Go get them. Who bears the burden? Not the supplier, as far as Congress is supposed to say. And you've got your own people on the ship. Who can bear the burden? Our people aren't on that ship. We're not. You know, looking at communicating back to the owner, these sorts of things.
Are you just basically saying that in an effort to protect U.S. suppliers, they collaterally benefit others as well in the amendments?
Yes, by choice of law, freedom of contract, they've done that. They've done that. And as the court goes...
a law magnet.
So, yes.
Essentially, so it becomes a beacon, and people put it in there, and then they hope that these ships then pull into U.S. ports or a port of one of these places that recognizes the lien. So if they pull in Tahiti, for example, Tahiti would apply U.S. law. And
yes.
Since it, France recognizes the lien.
Canada. This Kurgan Holdings case is straight opposite to the...
It's a little bit of business for our maritime lawyers.
It is an interesting business. That's for sure. That depends on this credit. And it's...
You don't think you guys want to just settle this case, do you? You know, it's not that much money. It's a couple of $100,000. It's peanuts.
Did you go through the mediation program in the Ninth
Circuit?
Yes,
we did.
You did?
Yes, we did. And the issue is significant to both sides.
You're not in it for the money, huh?
The issue is significant, yes. The money, well, Your Honor, the money is significant. The issue of international commerce and for bunker suppliers is significant.
If you lost, where would that leave you? If you significantly lost this case and you had an opinion that basically the other side.
Take it elsewhere.
We can hope that this would be the first maritime lien case since Gulf Oil to go up to the Supreme Court. It's a lot closer to home.
If you weren't successful in being one of the 70 cases to go to the U.S. Supreme Court next year, where would that leave you as a matter of commercial certainty?
That would leave us with a big problem. Because what would happen is every time one of these cases came up to this court, and thank goodness for Judge Wilson, because he did a magnificent job on this case.
Why are you appealing?
Why are you appealing?
Because he just needed, you know, it as I read the opinion, it was like that runner that gets to mile 25 and a half of the marathon, and he said, U.S. law applies, but... yes, Charlie Horse. And so what we'd like to do is help him get across that goal line, or that finish line, and just like lots of other courts would do, and were probably as fatigued as Judge Wilson, they tripped over this Trinidad case, and it gets repeated and repeated and repeated, and it really is a virus in maritime law, a small virus, but it causes problems, and if there's not this kind of certainty. Parties being able to choose law every time there's a ship arrest that involves a foreign provision, we are going to have to run through these Lauritzen factors, and not every place like Malaysia has Lexis. We might come up against the law of Taiwan or something like that. There has to be certainty in international transactions. The presence.
Well, the certainty that the other side proposition would give you is: look, if you have no U.S. connection, you can't hang your hat on U.S. law. That's pretty simple, isn't it?
Your Honor, first off, it's not like that there was no U.S. connection here. In our brief, we've cited the U.S. connections. But in maritime commerce, again, coming back to this charter party, the owner's own charter party has English law. No English connection in it. It is common to have choice of law clauses like this in maritime agreements. So what are they griping about? Here is U.S. law. It's going to be the one that bunker suppliers will choose. It's what you look for. In the bunker confirmation, it says there's a maritime lien when we give you our stuff. What are you going to do? Just overlook that? Let it go? Well, if everything works fine, your charterer gets credit. They pay the supplies out of the money they earn from the voyage, and you're just fine. You get your charter hire paid. everybody's happy. But when it breaks down like this, when the charterer goes out of business, then the question is, who is in the best position to bear the loss? If the owner has decided that they're going to benefit from the credit that the charterer gets from suppliers, then they got to take the downside to that. That's what was happening here. So they should expect these sort of clauses to show up. And the charter does tell you that they do expect that.
Thank you. Case is argued, 10 minutes. We are adjourned.